Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next 2 half-hour segments, we're going to take a look at some of the major capital flows of the 20th century, this by way of understanding or assimilating some background information to some of the recent topics that I've engaged in on this program. I suspect that some members of the listening audience may find some of my analysis concerning the Bormann Organization, the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, and also the relatively obscure Nazi-tracked Serpent's Walk to be somewhat unintelligible. And by way of gaining some understanding about just how what I have termed the Underground Reich has acquired some of the tremendous capital and power that it has, we're going to take a look at some of the events that underlie the not only the growth of fascism, but the acquisition and the coalescing of that financial power. I've done numerous shows about what I have termed the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that helped to build fascism in the first place. Some of those archive shows, by the way, available from Spitfire, include Uncle Sam and the Swastika, the first two Radio Free America shows, Radio Free America program number 10, the miscellaneous program Uncle Sam and Il Duce, and a number of different half-hour segments. And you can contact Spitfire for that information. What we're going to do, as I said, in the next 2 half-hour segments is to take a look at some of the key events in the operations of that transatlantic financial and industrial axis. And in particular, one could consider a hydraulic paradigm, a hydraulic model for some of the 20th century capital flows that have helped to lead to the acquisition of that power. Now, the first capital flow that we're going to look at concerns the recycling of the capital from the American boom of the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, over into Europe, because it was Europe in general, the fascist powers of Europe and Germany in particular, that were the repositories of this tremendous amount of capital that was generated in the booming America of the 1920s. And this flow is the first of the major capital flows from the United States and North America of the 1920s to Europe and Germany in particular. For our discussion of this first capital flow, and for most of the discussion this evening, we're going to take a look at a very important book still out in softcover. It's called The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. This book was authored by Christopher Simpson, the author of, among other titles, Blowback and The Science of Coercion, both of which I've used extensively on this program before. The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century, was published in softcover by Common Courage Press of Monroe, Maine, and is copyrighted 1995. You can reach Common Courage Press at Box 702, Monroe, Maine, 04951. Phone is 207-525-0900, and the fax is 207-525-3068. And as I said, what we're going to look at first concerns the capitalization of the fascist powers of Europe and Germany in particular in the 1920s. Germany was not yet fascist, but fascism was building in Europe. And in particular, not only was Europe in general and Germany in particular used as a vehicle for investment, but in particular, as we shall see, members of the American elite who wore the dual hats of captains of finance and industry and also master diplomats saw the building up of a strong anti-communist Germany and the restitution or the restoration of the German industrial elite as a bulwark against communism. Many of the Wall Street elite that we're going to look at, including people like John Foster and Alan Dulles from the pivotal Wall Street law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, and people like William Draper, later Brigadier General William Draper of Dillon Reed, a key Wall Street investment firm, had much to do with the capitalization of Germany and the capitalization of the companies that ultimately led to the rise of Nazism in Germany. And some of their cohorts and fellow associates in the State Department, such as people like Robert Murphy and William Bullitt of the Regia faction of the State Department, had much to do with shoring up this investment policy from a political and diplomatic standpoint. So we're looking at capital flows, and in particular, on the American side of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, one should pay attention to some of the business elite, some of the financial elite, who were closely allied with some of their colleagues in the elite who were diplomats. And later on, we're going to take a look at some of the elite's participation in the intelligence community and military in order to perpetuate this relationship. Turning to The Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson of the capitalization of Germany in the 1920s, the first of the major capital flows we're going to look at, we read, In confidential discussions, John Foster Dulles and the U.S. delegation, by the way, this is the U.S. delegation at the Versailles Conference, the Paris Peace Conference at the end of World War I. In confidential discussions, Dulles and the U.S. delegation placed greater stress on a second concern, the possibility of revolution or civil war in Europe. Secretary of State Lansing's comments quoted earlier concerning the, quote, terrible possibility of a proletarian despotism over Central Europe, unquote, directly argued that reparations must be kept low in order to avoid revolution. By the way, those reparations are German reparations payments after World War I. By the way, Secretary of State Lansing was a blood relative of John Foster and Alan Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell. Continuing. The Berlin and Budapest rebellions, both eventually suppressed with considerable bloodshed, seemed to provide vivid evidence to ruling circles that there was substance to Lansing's fears. Third, and perhaps most fundamentally, Dulles and the U.S. delegation were anxious to restart the engine of commerce that had been disrupted by the war. Without a German economic recovery, Norman Davis wrote, quote, it is impossible for the rest of Europe to get to work and be prosperous. It is most essential for the future stability of Europe that business confidence and credit be restored at the earliest possible moment, and these can never be restored as long as any large nation in Europe is struggling under a financial burden which the investors of the world think she cannot carry, unquote. Davis was not speaking simply of stability in some abstract sense, but rather of a particular type of order, one seen as sustainable by, quote, the investors of the world, unquote. And skipping down, we're now going to look at the actual capitalization of Germany to realize this policy. And in particular, we're going to take a look at John Foster Dulles, along with his brother Alan, key partners in the Sullivan and Cromwell Wall Street law firm. Later on, we're going to look at Dillon Reed, and bear in mind the name William Draper from Dillon Reed. Returning to the splendid blonde beast about the first of these major capital flows going from North America to Germany and Europe in the 20s, John Foster Dulles had meanwhile returned to the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, where he became a full partner specializing in the legal aspects of German reparations and in international finance generally. In 1923 and 4, banker J.P. Morgan recommended Dulles to be special counsel to the Dawes Committee, which U.S. and British banks had helped establish in the hopes of finding a way out of the reparations morass. Dulles helped engineer a scheme under which U.S. and foreign banks made new loans to the Reichsbank, the German state bank, which used the funds to pay reparations to Britain, France, and other European powers, who in turn paid off their own war loans from the U.S. This financial merry-go-round generated millions of dollars in interest payments for international lenders and kept billions of dollars worth of loans current just a bit longer. How long the borrowed money could continue to revolve remained an open question, but as long as it worked, John Foster Dulles was hailed as a master of international finance. By the way, Foster Dulles and the Dawes and Young plan are discussed in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, available from Spitfire. Continuing. Meanwhile, Dulles's law firm and his major clients pioneered a roughly similar system for private U.S. investment in German finance and industry. This new network of trade relations proved to be the most important single push forward in elite U.S.-German relations prior to World War II, though of course some ties between U.S. and German businessmen can be traced back to the 19th and even the 18th century. The United States had emerged from World War I with its currency and industry stronger than ever before, at least as long as Britain and other debtors continued to pay their bills. The 1920s boom, driven by imperialism, cheap oil, and the emerging automobile economy in the U.S., created enormous pools of investment funds in the banks of New York and Boston. This led to an international financial situation that was similar in some respects to the Middle East oil crisis of the 1970s. During the 1970s crisis, the central problem from the standpoint of international finance was to recycle the massive pools of funds that had shifted to the Middle East back through the international banking network in order to stave off a string of bankruptcies that would otherwise have resulted from illiquidity in the system. During the 1970s, most of this recycling, unquote, was carried out through the Eurodollar market. During the second half of the 1920s, the most important international market for recycling the new private U.S. wealth was Germany. This investment was carried out mainly through loans to German industry, direct U.S. investment in German companies, development loans to German cities, and millions of dollars worth of Dawes Plan credits that indirectly financed German war reparations. The scope of U.S.-German capital flows during the 1920s has never been fully documented, but the fraction of it that can be traced totals close to $1.5 billion, not including Dawes Plan credits. In today's currency, this sum would be measured in the tens of billions of dollars. There was considerable direct U.S. investment in German companies, as U.S. companies sought to buy into European markets at bargain prices. AT&T purchased a half dozen German telecommunications equipment manufacturers during the late 1920s and early 1930s, while General Motors bought part of the Adam Opel Corporation, and with it about 40% of the German automotive market in 1929. Fritz Opel joined GM's board of directors as part of the deal. Ford Motor Company built a vast factory at Cologne, then used it to manufacture cars for all of Central and Eastern Europe. There were also joint ventures such as IG Farben's pact with Standard Oil of New Jersey, some of which were subsequently found to be violations of U.S. law. General Electric purchased substantial shares of the German electronics giant AEG and Siemens, entered joint ventures with both companies. Specialized banks, law firms, and trading companies that focused on opening the German market to U.S. capital sprang up on both sides of the Atlantic. Practically without exception, the giant U.S.-German capital flows were administered by a small group of specialists at the very top of the social structure of both countries. A number of institutions and individuals who were prominent in this trade went on to play powerful roles in U.S.-German affairs over the next five decades. Dillon Reed and Company, private U.S. investment bankers, specialized in loans to Deutsche Bank, Siemens, and Fleek Interests. Between 1925 and the stock market crash in 1929, these loans amounted to more than $250 million. By the way, that was $250 million in the 1920s. That would be incalculably more today. Continuing, Friedrich Fleek built his fortune during the 1920s using bonds sold by Dillon Reed to finance what today might be called leveraged buyouts of German and Polish coal and steel companies. By the way, in a couple of half-hour segments entitled German Capital Investments or Corporate Investments in the United States, we talked about Friedrich Fleek, one of the Third Reich's most important industrialists and a convicted war criminal. He traded in at the end of World War II his exhausted mines and factories for majority ownership in the Daimler-Benz Corporation, whose board he then stocked with good, loyal Nazis. There is still major capital participation in Daimler-Benz by Friedrich Fleek, but I would note, as Daimler-Benz has now acquired the Chrysler Corporation, that Friedrich Fleek was not only a convicted war criminal, but saw to it that many unrepentant Nazis were put right back on the board of directors of the Daimler-Benz Corporation. But notice that his capital and his financial empire came from the Dillon Reed investments, hence my emphasis over the years on what I call this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that was absolutely essential to the rise of fascism in Europe. Continuing, we're going to return now to the splendid blonde beast, and note that most of the investments that took place in Europe, part of this first giant capital flow, took place in Nazi Germany, or what was soon to be Nazi Germany, and fascist Italy. Bear in mind that the companies that were the main repositories of U.S. capital were the central companies in not only financing Hitler's rise to power, but also in capitalizing and realizing German war industry. Continuing, the foreign borrowers, speaking of U.S. investment in Europe, the foreign borrowers included not only dozens of companies, but also governments as varied as Argentina, Czechoslovakia, and Denmark. However, Dulles clearly emphasized projects for Germany, for the military junta in Poland, and for Mussolini's fascist state in Italy. By the way, Poland under Marshal Pilsudski was a fascist country as well. As I mentioned, the American elite that ran Wall Street and American finance and industry, the American side of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, had a working partnership with some of their elite compatriots who worked in the State Department. The State Department faction that we're about to look at, the so-called RIGA faction, that's spelled R-I-G-A, saw not only American capital investment in Europe, but American cooperation with Nazi Germany as essential to realizing a global anti-communist policy. This RIGA faction had much to do with the acquiescence of the United States to the rise of fascism prior to World War II and the reinstitution of those fascist elements in Germany and Italy at the end of World War II as well. of this Regia faction, and in particular pay attention to the name Robert Murphy. We're going to come back to that later. Of this Regia faction, the State Department compatriots of the Wall Street financial and industrial elite that we just talked about, Christopher Simpson writes as follows in The Splendid Blonde Beast. The U.S. financial elite had great influence on U.S. foreign affairs, often manifested most directly in the Foreign Service, the career staff of the Department of State. As Paul Nitze's own career was to demonstrate, there was a revolving door between international service for major banks and law firms and positions in the U.S. State Department. There were many family ties, too, as when Alan Dulles remained in the Foreign Service and his brother returned to Sullivan and Cromwell. Paul Nitze, by the way, the author of NSC 68, the blueprint for U.S. waging of the Cold War, discussed in RFA 37, available from Spitfire, was a major investment banker with Dylan Reed. He later was called in by George Bush to head up the Team B analysis group that provided an altogether alarmist and exaggerated picture of Soviet intentions and capabilities in the late 1970s, which led to the election of Ronald Reagan and the huge U.S. military buildup, which bankrupted the United States in the 1980s. Skipping down, of this Regia faction in the State Department, after a discussion of how members of the American elite systematically excluded people who were not members of the elite, women, blacks, and Jews, from positions of power in the Department of State, Christopher Simpson goes on to write, of this Regia faction, and bear in mind, again, the name Robert Murphy, we're going to come back to that later, writing of the Regia faction, Simpson says, Robert Murphy, Loy Henderson, Joseph Grew, Hugh Gibson, George Keenan, James Clement Dunn, Eldridge Dubrow, Ray Atherton, Arthur Bliss Lane, and a handful of others became the backbone of the Foreign Service, particularly in all aspects of U.S., European, and later U.S.-Soviet relations. These self-perceived, quote, realists, unquote, believed that the USSR was the most dangerous long-term rival to the U.S., and that Germany and Central Europe should be integrated into some form of cordon sanitaire against the Bolsheviks. Their analysis was rooted in what Daniel Yergin has dubbed the Regia axioms, a collection of strongly anti-Soviet political postulates that crystallized among U.S. Foreign Service personnel during the 1920s at consulates in Regia, Latvia, Berlin, and Warsaw. The Regia Group's analysis was to have an enduring impact in escalating hostilities between the U.S. and USSR, as Yergin, Frederick Propas, Martin Weil, and others have documented. The Regia faction drew much of its most important support from the foreign policy elite outside the government. John Foster Dulles was among Regia's most articulate spokesmen, and men like James Forrestal and Paul Nitze of Dylan Reed, Charles Edward Wilson and Philip Reed of General Electric, and much of the leadership of the integrated DuPont General Motors U.S. rubber empire of that era, among others, were early supporters of the Regia postulates. By the way, bear in mind Philip Reed, we're going to come back to him later. Continuing. More to the point here, however, is the Regia Group's impact on U.S.-German relations, particularly after Hitler came to power. Perhaps the most influential proponent of the Regia axioms inside the government during the Roosevelt years was FDR's first ambassador to Moscow, William Bullitt. That's B-U-L-L-I-T-T. Continuing. He had arrived in the USSR full of enthusiasm for normalized U.S.-Soviet relations, but he left soon after convinced, quote, that only Nazi Germany could stay the advance of Soviet Bolshevism in Europe, unquote. As will be seen in a later chapter, many of the career State Department officials who were to specialize in U.S.-German relations, war crimes policy, and so-called Jewish issues, such as rescue of refugees during World War II, shared Bullitt's cynical enthusiasm for Hitler's talents. And what we're going to look at next concerns a group of, and by the way, bear in mind the Regia faction and their corresponding allies in the Wall Street financial and industrial elite. We're going to take a look at their operations during and after World War II as well, helping to restore their compatriots on the German side of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. What we're going to look at now is the makeup and political and economic philosophy of some of the elite German members on the German side of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. In particular, some of the captains of German finance and industry sought a corporatist policy. They, rather than following the SS paradigm of a self-sufficient German economic empire and political empire in Central and Eastern Europe, these German members of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis sought to keep Germany involved in foreign markets and sought to implement a policy of German conquest in which German arms would be seen as a vehicle for acquiring leverage for German business. And they took this corporatist philosophy as a model for German control in Europe. Of the philosophy of this corporatist faction of the German end of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, Christopher Simpson writes as follows. In contrast, much of the banking and industrial elite of Germany favored a more traditional imperial approach to acquiring a new empire in Europe. Among their principal spokesmen were Economics Minister Hjalmar Schacht, Hermann Obst of the Deutsche Bank, and a young Reichsbank director, Carl Blessing. Their strategy favored integrating businesses in countries occupied by the Germans into private industrial syndicates coordinated through German-based cartels and through private institutions such as Deutsche Bank. The private companies, in turn, pledged their loyalty to Hitler's government. German military conquest should be used to create conditions through which German corporations could buy up the key enterprises in newly subjugated countries at very favorable prices, this faction contended, but only in rare instances should the state take direct command of industry. Much of the senior leadership of the Deutsche Bank, IG Farben, the Siemens Group of Companies, and other German-based cartels maintained that Germany should re-enter the world marketplace rather than attempt to build up the orthodox Nazi dream of a self-sufficient German empire in Central and Eastern Europe. And what we're going to look at next is the second of the major capital flows that I've discussed in that we're discussing in these segments. Now, this is a major capital flow from the coffers of the occupied nations of Europe into the coffers of the Third Reich. And this major capital flow, quite literally a preconceived and very effective looting of all of the liquid wealth of occupied Europe, represented the realization of this corporatist faction within the German side of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, and the use of bank clearing procedures and currency exchange rates in order to effect this second major capital flow, which can be conceived as going from the coffers of the occupied nations of Europe, or the treasuries of the occupied nations of Europe, into the treasuries of the treasury of the Third Reich, and into the bank accounts of the major corporations that participated in the Third Reich. This is the second of these major capital flows that we're looking at in these segments. And once again, the influence and cooperation of the American end of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis was absolutely central as we take a look at some of the aforementioned Dulles brothers of Sullivan and Cromwell's operations in connection with the Bank for International Settlements, or BIS. Of Alan Dulles and his attempts to whitewash German industrialists who had participated in Hitler's crimes and to indicate that they should be restored to power after World War Europe, and the influence of the Bank of Industrial Settlements on some of Dulles' judgments, Christopher Simpson writes as follows. Dulles' recently declassified OSS telegrams show that his principal sources of information on the German financial and industrial elite were officials of the Bank for International Settlements, or BIS, in Basel, Switzerland, which had worked closely with Berlin banking circles since the first years of Hitler's regime. The BIS provided sophisticated currency clearing services to a dozen industrial countries and served as a private policy council where representatives of central banks met to discuss monetary policy. As we shall see, it also represented one of the many institutions which joined together the American and German ends of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. And as we will see, the BIS was one of the major vehicles used by the Third Reich for the second major capital flow, the looting of the coffers of occupied Europe. Continuing. The Dulles family had played an important role in the bank from its inception, so it was not surprising that Alan Dulles would turn to his contacts there. The institution had been founded to carry out the international clearing necessary for the reparations programs John Foster Dulles had helped pioneer after World War I, and the bank's first chronicler and most enthusiastic supporter was his sister, Eleanor Lansing Dulles. Both Allen and John Foster Dulles sat on the boards of New York and London affiliates of European companies led by men on the BIS board of directors, and an American with long social and business ties to the Dulleses, Thomas McKittrick, became president of the BIS in 1940. And, skipping down, notwithstanding the fact that McKittrick was its president, the BIS was thoroughly dominated by Axis interests due to bank bylaws that allocated votes on bank policy according to financial contributions. Axis powers had controlled a plurality of BIS votes throughout the 1930s, and as the Blitzkrieg progressed, control of more central banks fell into German hands. By the end of 1942, Germany and the Axis controlled more than 75% of the votes on the BIS board. The BIS remained officially neutral, but as a practical matter, its allegiances shifted with the fortunes of war. During McKittrick's presidency, the BIS cooperated with the German Reichsbank's efforts to launder gold stolen from the mouths of death camp victims, in part because German Finance Minister Walter Funk was first among equals on the BIS's wartime board of directors. The institution also joined in a complex Nazi scheme to use currency manipulation and bank clearing procedures to loot the economies of entire countries. Now, in the strategy that I'm about to detail, we can see the realization of the corporatist strategy that was favored by some of the key German members of the German end of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, namely using German arms in order to conquer countries whose economies could then be restructured in a manner favorable to the occupying Germans. And this constitutes the second major capital flow, namely the looting of the coffers of the occupied nations. Continuing. Both programs led to charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity against the Germans involved in the scheme. McKittrick and other BIS executives, however, were never charged. The bank clearing schemes deserve special notice because of their significant but little-known role in looting the equivalent of billions of dollars from Nazi-occupied territories. Importantly, this form of looting was, for the most part, organized and managed by ordinary German corporate executives and their foreign collaborators, not by the SS or die-hard Nazis. Here again, the Nazis succeeded in harnessing the in-place, more or less conventional social machinery of trade to the tasks of the Hitler government. In this way, billions of Reichsmarks worth of wealth in the countries occupied by the Nazis shifted into German hands, often before the victimized country even understood what was happening. Germany had instituted basic monetary clearing procedures during the 1930s as a means of controlling the flow of foreign currencies in and out of the Reich. In its simplest form, a German company interested in trade with, say, Belgium would pay for Belgian goods in German currency to the German central bank, the Reichsbank in Berlin. The Reichsbank would send what amounted to an international IOU to the Belgian central bank for the amount it had been paid by the German company. The Belgian central bank would then pay the Belgian company the money for its goods in Belgian currency. Hundreds of other companies in many countries were involved in thousands of similar deals. Then, at regular intervals, the central bank would meet at the BIS, total up the credits and debits of all the business deals, and clear them by making a settlement between central banks that balanced their accounts. The creation of this central channel for foreign exchange permitted Hitler's government to monitor and license most transactions between Germans and foreigners. These procedures contributed significantly to the Aryanization of Jewish property because they closed off opportunities to transfer assets abroad for all but a handful of the wealthiest and best-connected German Jews. During Germany's wartime occupation of foreign countries, Hitler's government took effective control of both sides of the clearing equation and thus could manipulate each contract to its advantage. German bankers took over most of the central banks in the occupied countries, staffing those institutions with German professionals and compliant foreigners. We're going to take a look at the further development of this policy in our second half-hour segment. That concludes this half-hour. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.